Welcome to The Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we talk with Marcus Arbon about how the simulation hypothesis explains various philosophical phenomena, including free will.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Marcus Arbon, professor of philosophy at the University of Tampa. Marcus's research focuses on moral and political theory, AI ethics and safety, cognitive science, metaphysics, and the philosophy of science. He's written a handful of papers on free will, including a paper called A New Theory of Free Will, published in Philosophical Forum in 2013. And Marcus has also written about the simulation hypothesis and time, real and simulated. And we're going to talk about some of those topics in connection with free will today. So thanks for joining us, Marcus. Could you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on issues related to free will?
Yeah, sure. So again, thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be here. I'm professor of philosophy at the University of Tampa. Been there since 2009. Outside of philosophy, I'm a musician, recording artist, and I used to be a gamer, right? And actually, when we talk about my philosophical views today, we'll see that actually they really influenced my thinking here. I work in a wide variety of areas, primarily ethics and social and political philosophy, but also metaphysics, philosophy of mind, and AI. So in terms of coming to think about free will, you know, there's this saying, I can't remember who said it, that philosophy is a matter of understanding how things fit together in the broadest way of understanding that question, right? And I've always kind of been a bit of a synthesizer, right? Like big picture, interested in how different philosophical problems and phenomena fit together. And so I came to be interested in free will as a result of thinking about consciousness and time and causation, personal identity, free will, music, video games, and Kant's metaphysics and moral metaphysics. So I'll spell out like a little bit how this came to be. So I started thinking about a bunch of dualities in philosophical problems, right? So if we think about, you know, the hard problem of consciousness and mind, right? There's, of course, the physical world, right? And physical laws and properties. And this nagging suspicion, right, that consciousness is something more, right? There's like another side to things, a further fact, right? And we see a similar dualities across a number of different perennial philosophical problems, right? So if we think about like the nature of time, right, we've got eternalism, the view that all times exist, but we also have this feeling, this nagging suspicion that there's something special about the present, right? And the present marches forward. And it seems to be this kind of further fact above and beyond the sequence of events, right? If we think about causation, right? So, you know, Hume said, well, what we observe is regularities between events. But we have, again, this nagging suspicion that there's something more, some kind of necessitation, right? Some kind of determination between distinct events, right? That goes beyond merely what we empirically observe. If we think about personal identity, right? So, you know, there are theories that personal identity is a matter of bodily continuity, right? Continuity of organism. And then there's like psychological continuity theories. But again, there's still this nagging suspicion that what makes you, you is something more, something like your conscious perspective on the world, right? And if we look at the problem of free will, right, there's been this long-standing, you know, arguably even stagnant debate between compatibilists and incompatibilists and these libertarians who say, you know, there's something more to free will than can be explained in terms of, right, you know, brain states or physical laws. And so we see these kind of dualities across a wide variety of philosophical problems. And, you know, as a moral philosopher and somebody who's, you know, studied Kant for a long time, of course, Kant, his entire philosophical picture, right, contains at its core a duality between what he calls phenomena, or how the world presents itself to us, and noumena, right, which are things in themselves, right? And so my feeling, you know, thinking about free will and all these problems is that that distinction between how things appear to us and how things are in themselves, right, is really important in some way. And then, of course, right, Kant has a view that I think sort of anticipates the kind of view that I want to defend, where he says, you know, the world of phenomena, the world that we that presents itself to us, presents itself as though it's causally closed, right? As though, right, our, you know, physical states, you know, determine subsequent states and our choices. But from our first personal perspective, Kant points out, we seem to experience a kind of radical freedom, right? An ability to decide and make our choices independently of whatever kind of, you know, sensible inclinations present themselves to us. Okay. Mm-hmm. So those are the philosophical problems and the kind of dualities that I was thinking about. And as a musician, right, you know, I was recording music, right? And I'm like looking at my monitor and I've got the entire song, you know, plotted out in front of me, all the musical parts. And I press the space bar to listen to the song. And of course, there's the line that progresses, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. across the music. And it seemed to me to sort of represent that kind of duality. Like the music, in some sense, is all there, if you think kind of like eternalism about time. Mm-hmm. But it only presents itself when it's read by a kind of external mechanism, right? This computer processor, which is presenting that information to me. And then I started thinking about, because I was a video game player at the time, right, about how video games work, right? So, you know, at the time, right, video games were basically on, you know, compact discs or CDRs, right? And all of the information that comprised the world of a game is encoded digitally onto that disc, but it doesn't, so to speak, come alive as an environment until it's read by an external source, right? The computer processor. And so then I began thinking about how that analogy could perhaps, you know, enlighten a variety of philosophical problems, and again, brought me in the direction of a version of, as you mentioned, the simulation hypothesis and how that might help us understand free will.
Yeah. Cool. So for listeners who've never heard of the simulation hypothesis, could you give us some basic background about it and why some philosophers like David Chalmers or Nick Bostrom sure. take it seriously?
Yeah. So, right. The simulation hypothesis is that we live in a computer, right? Our reality is computer generated. Now, there's, you know, two possibilities about how we might live in a computer simulation. So the first is that we are simulated beings ourselves, right? We are sort of digital, right, constructions, right? And everything about us is a kind of computer program. The other possibility, which sort of antedated that philosophically, is what's known as the brain and vat hypothesis, right? So that our reality is a computer simulation, but that we are attached to it from the outside as something like fleshy brains, you know, hooked up to a simulation, much as in the Matrix trilogy, right? Where mm-hmm. Neo is a human being in a higher level of reality, and he's trapped in a computer simulation, you know, hooked up to it from the outside. So those are two distinct possibilities. So the most influential argument for the simulation hypothesis, and I don't think it's the best argument, but it's the one that's gotten the most attention, is the one from Nick Bostrom, right? And, you know, to simplify it considerably, he holds really roughly that most beings with experiences like ours, right, are simulated characters, right, on what he calls ancestor simulations. So, you know, how does he defend this? What the basic idea is, right, that what he calls a post-human civilization might be possible, right? So a civilization that has incredible technological abilities. And then he begins thinking about, well, what would a post-human civilization do? Well, look, in our world, we're not a post-human civilization yet. We already run a lot of simulations. We've got video games, right? We've got, right, virtual realities. And he thinks, look, a post-human civilization would have the ability and likely the motivation to create simulations of their history, right? Their entire history. And they would be able to construct a vast number of them, right? And of course, there could be a vast number of post-human civilizations throughout the universe. And so the basic idea is, because it's plausible that there could be a vast number of simulated worlds like ours, and by definition, there can only be one ground or non-simulated reality, the simple number of probable explanations of our existence is that we're in one of the many simulated realities and not the only one, all right, non-simulated ground reality. Because mm-hmm. again, the probability is simply greater. There's more of the simulated realities of people like us than there could be real people like us not simulated. And so the simulation hypothesis is therefore more probable.
Yeah. That's interesting. So you've introduced a new version of the simulation hypothesis that you call the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis. And you argue that this hypothesis is implied by some other hypotheses in physics and in philosophy, and also that it can explain some otherwise baffling phenomena, including one about free will. So we'll link to your papers in the show notes for listeners who would like to see the diagrams, which were helpful as I was looking through the papers. But can you tell us what exactly the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis is?
Sure. So, you know, people who have played video games, right? We all have had the experience where what's called you have a problem with the server and the game ends, right? So most video games have what is called a dedicated server, right? So here you are in your living room playing your game, right? You're playing a video game. Someone else on the other side of the world is also playing the game against you. But what happens in a dedicated server game is that every player on the network, right, is accessing a central computer. And that central computer represents where everything in the game is, right? Your player, every other player, every object, every bullet or whatever, you know, weapon. And so there is, in a dedicated server simulation, right, determinant, right, place and velocity for everything in the simulation, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an objective reality that all the players in the simulation are playing within. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the downsides, as I just mentioned, for a dedicated server simulation is that they can be really unstable, right? So if the server goes down or it runs into an informational bottleneck, right, there can be serious problems with the network. Or the game will either end or things will slow down in a way that's really noticeable. So a way to sort of avoid that problem, those problems, is to actually have a simulation where there is no dedicated server, right? So in a peer-to-peer simulation, every player is running their own version of the game locally, right? So if I'm playing in my living room, my computer here is running the simulation for me. If you're playing against me in your living room, your computer is running the simulated environment for you. So what is the simulated reality? Well, because there's no dedicated server, it's simply I have mine, you have yours, every other player has theirs, and they're talking to each other in real time, communicating where they're representing objects in the environment to make sure that they're representing them in the same place or in close enough of a same place in the environment for the game to be able to be convincing for the players that are playing it. Right. And what's really neat about this, or so I've argued, is that it can help us understand some really baffling aspects of physics in our world, which people have, you know, struggled to understand for, you know, over 100 years. Right. And I think it can help us understand some philosophical problems as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what are some of the phenomena or the problems that you take the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis to explain?
Sure. So the first two have to do with fundamental physics, right? So, you know, I don't want to get too in the weeds on quantum mechanics and relativity, but here's the short thing about quantum mechanics, right? Quantum mechanics says that every object in our world, right? I mean, every electron, every proton, there's no determinant place where that thing is, right? Quantum mechanics says every particle is in what's called a superposition, which is to say it's in many places at once somehow until a measurement is taken, right? Until you actually try to figure out where it is, and then you'll find it somewhere, right? That sounds really weird. But here's the other weird thing about it. It turns out, according to quantum mechanics, that when two people measure the same electron at the same time, they can actually measure it to be in two different spots or with two different velocities. And this isn't just a theory. There have been experiments that have shown that people measuring the same object at the same time will find different properties in that object. And right, somehow, right, the thought is particles in many places at once, when you measure them, they collapse down to a point, which is called the wave function collapse. Quantum mechanics gives us equations to explain how all of these probabilities work, but nobody's quite been able to explain like why quantum mechanics is the way that it is. Like, why is our world so weird like this, right? And my argument is like, look, the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis provides a really nice and intuitive functional explanation about like why our world should be like this. In a peer-to-peer simulation, any object is not in a particular determinate place in the dedicated server, like in a single spot. Rather, every player on the network, their console is representing the object for them, right? And so if you sum across, right, all of the different computers on the network, if they're not all representing the object being at the same place, what the characteristic of the whole will be is a massive superposition, right, of a single object being at place A and B and C and D and E all at once. But whenever somebody takes a measurement, they will always find it, just as in our world quantum mechanics says, they'll always find that object in a particular spot. Right. So the idea is, right, the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis explains these otherwise completely baffling features of quantum mechanics, of fundamental physics, that we really don't have, I think, any other good explanation for why they should be things in our reality at all. So that's one thing, right? Again, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but, you know, the theory of relativity, right? The basic insight, right, that Einstein had, right, is that all events, right, time and space, right, are relative to observers or reference frames, right? There is no objective reference frame on events. There is, right, where objects and properties are from my reference frame, for your reference frame, right? But of course, again, and that seems really bizarre, right? Because, of course, some of the implications of this are if you, you know, travel really fast on a spaceship to a distant planet and travel really fast back, from one reference frame, some number of years, say 20 will have passed, but from another reference frame, a different number of years, say 150 years will have passed. And that seems contradictory. How can 100 years, 150 and 20 years both pass? Well, if everyone has their own reference frame and there is no objective reference frame, there's no contradiction. And again, the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis says every player on the network, fundamentally, their simulation is their reference frame, right? And it only communicates with other simulations that have their own unique reference frame. So in a peer-to-peer simulation, just as in relativity, there is no objective reference frame. There's simply the reference frame of every player on the network. And so again, we've got a kind of explanation for this baffling feature of fundamental physics that we don't otherwise have, I think, a good explanation for. So that's like the physical side of things, right? But if we begin to think then about the kind of dualities, right, that I sort of mentioned earlier, right, the thought is, and I don't know if this is, you know, unique to the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis, but in conjunction with it, I think is really powerful. It's like, look, we've got then a kind of explanation of the mind-body problem, right? Because people in a simulation would have this hankering suspicion that there's something more to their subjective perspective, right, to their minds, then can be explained by the world that they measure around them, right? And of course, if you're in a simulation, you would be right, right? Because the environment that you're perceiving around you is the software of the game, right? But there's something fundamentally different about your perspective in the game. Namely, it's comprised in a simulation by whatever is reading that software from the outside, whether it's a brain in a vat like Neo in a higher level reality, or right, whether it's right some other kind of simulated right console like I'm playing in my living room right now, right, or a real console. So I want to say it helps explain the mind-body problem about why, in fact, there is something more to our minds, right, than can be explained by the physical world. Because in a simulation, the reality is that there's hardware behind us, right, and that comprises our perspective. Same thing with the problem of personal identity, right? People in a simulation would think, look, right, I understand I have my body in this world, I have my psychological characteristics in this world, but there seems to be something special that, like, if I stepped in a teleporter, even if my body changed and even if my psychology changed, it could be me, right? But somehow there's something more to me than I can perceive in the world around me. And again, if we're in a simulation, we'd be right in thinking that. Again, our personal identity would be something in a higher reference frame, namely what is giving rise to the simulation for us. Same issue with the problem of time, right? So people in a simulation would think that the moving present is in some way special, right? That outstrips their explanation of, right, the order of events in the world. And again, they'd be right, because time's passing is comprised by the hardware and software that is generating their perspective in the game or in the simulated world. So I want to say, look, it helps us understand, you know, fundamental physics in various ways, helps us understand a bunch of philosophical problems, but then can finally really help us, you know, think about a new way of understanding the problem of free will and potentially solving it. Although we'll talk about concerns about the view in a few minutes, I take it. But look, let's think about, you know, video games. What started me thinking about this is, you know, I'm gonna date myself a little bit here, right? My favorite game as a kid was Ms. Pac-Man, right? This, like, you know, this game that you sat on playing with the joystick. Now, look, everything in Ms. Pac-Man's world, right? All of the walls, right? All of the dots, all of the ghosts that are chasing her around are kind of a deterministic algorithm, right? There's no freedom in the system. But of course, there's one place that there's freedom in the system. It's namely me controlling Ms. Pac-Man from the outside, right? So from her perspective, if she were observing the world around her, she would think, well, everything's determined in my world, but she'd have a sneaking suspicion that there's something special about her, that her ability to make choices outstrips the laws of her reality. And again, she would be right. Right? Because it's me controlling her from the outside in a way that is not determined by her reality. Right? And so I term this general view libertarian compatibilism, right? Because there's a sense in which Ms. Pac-Man has libertarian free will from the standpoint of her world, right? There's inputs that are not determined by the laws of her reality, right? That are comprising her choices, right? Mm-hmm. That's compatible otherwise with all of the determination of every other single event in her world, right? And so we can, again, in a unique kind of way, by making reference to reference frames, hold that what appears deterministic in one reference frame, the reference frame of her world, is not deterministic if we think about it from a higher reference frame, because we can see that there's a place in her world where we're creating inputs that are not determined in her reference frame. That's the basic idea.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Are you using the computer simulation in a metaphorical way, or is it like a literal computer simulation?
Okay. So good. This is where I don't take a stance in the New Theory of Free Will paper. And I intentionally did it that way, and I'm sticking to it. Right? Because what I want to say is, well, either it's likely we live in a peer-to-peer simulation because it's a really good explanation for things we don't, and unified, right, explanation for things that we don't otherwise have, I think, a good explanation for. Or we live in something that is functionally akin to a peer-to-peer simulation, but is different. Like perhaps, you know, I don't know, God, right, networked conscious awareness or souls, right? Hooking them up to reading the information of the world. And so it's like similar to a peer-to-peer simulation, but something metaphysically distinct from it. And I say, I can't tell you which of those is right. I mean, the latter one sounds bizarre, but again, I mean, any sort of, you know, metaphysical theory involving God and you know, is going to sound magical in a variety of ways. And I can say more about how I think that regardless of what our metaphysics is, we got to invoke magic of some sort. So I don't know how we can have evidence one way or the other with it. You know, if we're stuck in a video game, so to speak, about like which of those two possibilities is actually the case, that we're actually in a peer-to-peer video game or something like it, right? Mm-hmm. But that is metaphysically distinct from it in really interesting ways. And just throw up my hands and say, hey, maybe we can never know this, right?
Yeah. That's interesting. That reminds me of some of David Chalmers' work where he compares the simulation hypothesis, or at least some versions of it, with the kind of idealism you find in George Berkeley, who has a myth that's not too dissimilar from what you just described, where you have these conscious souls and God's arranged things so they are having similar sensory experiences, even though there's no such thing as matter. I love thinking about that view, as weird as it is, and then trying to press, especially my students, to see that the world might be even weirder than that if that's not the case.
Yeah.
One question that I had about the time dilation stuff is how that works if you have a non-conscious particle or object that's sent on the rocket ship very fast away from Earth and then back. Because I take it that one of the implications of relativity is even if we put a non-conscious rock on the rocket ship, sent it near the speed of light, you know, to a faraway place and then brought it back from its perspective, right? But it's not a conscious perspective, but from its perspective, like less time will have passed than from our perspective here on Earth. Is that compatible with your view? Because the way you described it was more about the conscious perspective.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it is, right? Because if you think that the relativity of time, right, is a necessary implication of peer-to-peer networking. And it has to be, right? Because every simulation is, right, got its own reality. And it takes time for one reference frame to communicate with another, right? Which is another interesting aspect that it might help explain why our universe has a speed limit, right? Like, why is the speed of light the speed limit? Right. It's like, well, one explanation is because in a peer-to-peer network, it does take time for nodes on the network to communicate with one another. And so there has to be a kind of informational speed limit in any kind of peer-to-peer networked reality. Now, here's the thought, at least as a first stab at answering your question. Insofar as the relativity of space-time to reference frames is an implication of peer-to-peer networking, right? Then the nodes would have to basically understand the rest of their universe in a way that is consistent or coherent with that kind of time dilation, right? So if there were violations of time dilation for an unobserved electron moving from place to place, that would pop out as something incoherent with the relative perspectives of, right? Or I mean, it would be inexplicable otherwise, right? Mm-hmm. Given the otherwise relative to reference frame nature of observations, right?
Yeah.
And so it would either result in contradictions or people in the world thinking, here's this strange thing about electrons that are unobserved that we can't explain. I mean, we already have a bunch of problems like that, but you might think this is like the programmer's best attempt at avoiding a paradox or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Hmm. Okay, cool.
I have a follow-up question based on Taylor's point about George Berkeley.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Donald Hoffman? I think he's at UC Irvine. He's a scientist who's been studying perception and using these evolutionary arguments where they run simulations and the organisms in the simulation that are tuned to see reality as it is are always outcompeted by the organisms who are tuned to see reality, none of it as it is, but just tuned to fitness. And so he's got this elaborate kind of argument that kind of goes with Berkeley that we're not actually seeing the world as it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's like super interesting, right? I had heard of Donald Hoffman's argument. I didn't know that he'd actually run like computer simulations with different kinds of organisms to bolster the case for that. That's super cool. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the hypotheses that works its way into a new theory of free will paper that I wrote is what's called the holographic principle, right? And the holographic principle holds that like everything that we observe, right, my body, right, the computer that I'm looking at, is in effect a hologram projected off of the boundary of the universe, right? And, you know, that sort of makes sense of like from Hoffman's perspective, like, you know, the reality, right, is very different than what we observe, right? We take ourselves to be, you know, picking up a soda can and drinking it right now. Mm-hmm. The reality is that's you know, on the holographic principle, just information encoded mm-hmm. on the boundary of the universe that's being projected for a mind, right? Yeah, I think that's super interesting. I'm not quite sure what more to say about it, but yeah, that's cool.
Well, you use the term libertarian compatibilism to describe your new theory of free will, which for some of our listeners might sound like a contradiction because, you know, libertarians, as you mentioned, are incompatibilist believers in free will. But you're not contradicting yourself, because the view is that while determinism may be true from one frame of reference, that's compatible with our having libertarian free will in a distinct frame of reference. And actually, we talked about a kind of similar view, and maybe, I don't know if he thinks of it as inspired by Kantian sort of two frame of reference sort of approach, but Christian List has a similar view about different sort of levels of explanation. This does raise another question, though, which is, well, I think that we have libertarian free will sort of outside the simulation or from some other frame of reference.
Right? I get this question. I've gotten this question ever since I wrote this paper, right? Because, you know, to go back to the video game analogy, right? It's like when I'm playing Ms. Pac-Man, I mean, it's possible that all of my actions moving around the joystick are entirely determined by the physics of this reference frame, which is higher than her reference frame, right? So, you know, here's my terribly disappointing answer, right? It's to defer to the point that I made earlier. Is that I don't know for sure, right? I don't think we can, right? There's two possibilities. Either, right, in the higher reference frame, the simulation and whatever we are, whether it's a brain in a vat or a program, is determined by physical law at the higher level, or in some way it's not, that somehow, you know, perhaps consciousness is completely undetermined by laws of nature at that higher level of reality. And sadly, I say, we can't know which of those two possibilities it is, but it does open up the possibility for there being true libertarian free will in a way that's compatible with apparent causal closure in our world.
Well, what are some of the challenges that you've come across to your view and the ones that keep you up at night, and how are you going to respond to them?
So there's one, of course, we just mentioned, is the evidence issues. Like, what evidence do we have for this? And, you know, I think that there, you know, there have been hypotheses for how we might, you know, test whether we're living in a simulation. And I think there's some interesting work here being done. But one thing that the view does predict is that there should be violations of like the normal quantum wave function, right? If we like are able to study human beings, right, brains, and in that way we might find out that we're player characters. And if we study animal brains and they don't have violations of the normal wave function, maybe they're like non-player characters, right? But that's one issue. It's like, well, what evidence could we have beside these kind of explanatory, right, inference to the best explanation for explaining physics and philosophical problems? Okay. But I'm kind of optimistic, right? There are various ways that we might be able to develop, you know, tests that suggest that maybe this picture is true. Okay. The deeper question, right, which I think is a problem for any like libertarian theory, right, is this idea of, you know, choice or freedom ex nihilo, right? Like an uncaused cause from nothing. And that does seem to be you know, a kind of requirement for libertarian free will. I mean, I know like Robert Kane doesn't, in his view, seem to think this. It's just, you know, libertarian free will is some kind of like just chance. But that doesn't seem good enough, right? Because it just seems like coin flipping then, right? It seems like genuine libertarian free will requires us, you know, consciousness to be some kind of uncaused cause. And of course, the worry is that seems like it's incoherent. Right. If our choices are not caused by something, like our, you know, beliefs or desires that are caused by previous events, then it seems like they're caused by nothing. Right. Which you might think libertarian free will is simply incoherent. So talking about libertarian compatibilism is just a waste of time. I take that really seriously. But I guess, you know, the best answer I have is I think that invoking, you know, because it seems like just inexplicable magic that somehow we're able to make one decision rather than another from nothing other than choice, right? Which sounds like, you know, again, a circular argument. It seems to me like something like this is inevitable when understanding the fundamental nature of reality, right? Because, like, you know, when people invoke God, God is supposed to be an uncaused cause that explains everything else. But okay, so if you don't think that that makes sense, then people want to say, well, the universe is just here. Okay, that looks like it's an uncaused cause, and you've invoked magic. Like, and why does everything in the universe act in a regular manner? Like, why does gravity always work and things always fall? And the answer is, well, it just does from nothing. That's just the way it is. And so regardless of, you know, what you think the explanation for reality is, you have to invoke some seemingly incoherent magic somewhere. And so yeah. I'm not terribly worse off in positing a libertarian compatibilism as a possibility than like any other metaphysics right. of the world is.
Yeah.
And again, philosophically, that's kind of disappointing. But, you know, like one of the things you learn early on as a philosopher that like, you know, you answer what you can and have humility mm-hmm. enough to not think you have answers when you don't. Right. And, you know, yeah.
I've thought a lot about this appeal to weirdness. I don't know what else to call it. Like, oh, if this view was true, it'd be so weird and it'd be so extraordinary or whatever, like the magic objection to yeah. things like libertarian free will. And the more I learn about science, the more crazy and weird stuff that we find out is true because of science. So why would we expect it not to be true in metaphysics?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, all the stuff, you know, about like quantum mechanics and relativity is weird, but just like more basically, reality working is weird, right? Yeah. The fact that like gravity always works the way that it does. There's this really, I think it's the best argument, I think, for something like God is this recent paper, the psychophysical harmony argument about like mm-hmm. why there is a kind of harmony between experience and the world. Donald Hoffman obviously challenges that, but yeah. There's the general argument going back to like Leibniz and others is like the harmony of the universe is this baffling magical issue about how the universe works at all, how there are regularities as opposed to like, you know, random irregularities. Mm-hmm. So I think that's exactly right. Right. You got to accept weirdness regardless of your stance on things. So to say that this particular vision of reality is weird isn't to say very much.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of weirdness, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask about time travel, because as regular listeners have probably guessed, it's one of my favorite topics in philosophy. And you've written a little bit about it in connection with the simulation hypothesis. So what implications does the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis have for how we think about time travel?
Yeah. So there's this famous scene in Back to the Future, right? You know, Marty McFly goes back in time, right? And he, like, his mom has the hots for him, right? And it's like falling in love with Marty instead of his dad. Right. And it's like, you know, if she keeps falling in love with him, he's like not going to be born, right? And of course, right. he's like playing Johnny B. Good on his guitar, you know, at the school dance. And he's got his picture of him and his sister on the guitar, right? And the picture is like slowly fading, right? Because she's like falling in love with him. And it like he actually starts to like fade from existence, and you know, and he's sort of like fading back in. And it's like you might think like that doesn't make any sense, right? Like metaphysically, it's like, you know, he can't change the past because like the past already happened, right? And so he couldn't like erase the picture of him because he was born. Okay. So you might think, you know, as fun of a story as it is, Back to the Future is like metaphysically incoherent. And, you know, the peer-to-peer simulation hypothesis is, well, no. I mean, if we're living in a video game, it's perfectly coherent for like one player, right, running their part of the simulation to like time travel back to quote unquote earlier events in the simulation, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, the player, right, or the hardware is all right here in the present in our frame of reference. The player in the game can travel to earlier events in the timeline of the game. And it's quite possible, right, for their actions in that earlier part of the game to communicate to the other nodes in the network of the players who are playing the present of the game to alter the code that it's selecting in the present so that it updates, right, the present, as it were, taking players into a quote-unquote different timeline. So they might actually experience like a photograph from the past fading in their present because of the choice that another player made traveling back in time. And there's no incoherence about it because all that's happening, there's no actual time travel, like real time travel in the higher dimension that the games are working in. Rather, it's simply different readers of the software, right? Reading different parts of the software to rearrange objects and properties at different points in the sequence, right? And so there's no kind of time travel paradox for simulated real time. Like in simulated real time, anything is possible, right? Because, right, it's simply, you know, computer consoles moving forward in real time, deciding how to arrange the game and rearrange, you know, the game for different players at different points in the timeline in the game. Mm-hmm. So there's no paradox for simulated time travel, whereas there is potentially for real time travel.
Right.
Yeah, this seems like it's directly related to the grandfather paradox. So yeah. Are you saying that it's possible for someone to go back in time and kill their own grandfather?
Simulated game, sure, right? I mean, you know, you kill your grandfather, but the game is programmed to say, hey, your character gets to continue living. There's no paradox, right? Because you're not traveling into the real past. You're just altering the code that the game reads moving forward. You've, quote unquote, killed your grandfather, but it doesn't determine the future of the game because that's a matter of the programming, whatever the programmers wanted to make possible. Mm-hmm.
It kind of makes me think of like if you're in a video editing software platform where you can go and edit earlier frames in the video from some later reference point, right? You might have changed the past relative to the end of the video by tinkering with the earlier frames, but you haven't done any time travel, any real time travel, right? And yeah, it's similarly, exactly. Yeah, you affect the history of your character in a game, but it's more like going back and tinkering with the video, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I guess I'd love to think more about how, whether that sort of in-game time travel counts as genuine time travel, because one way of thinking about it, it's genuine time travel for characters in the game.
Good. Yeah.
Especially if they're in a kind of version of the simulation hypothesis where there's no brain in the vat or, you know, mm-hmm. Neo outside the matrix, that really is their whole perspective. It's just that, well, time's multidimensional in some sense, given the reality as a whole.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's kind of the stance that I take on it in my one paper that I've written on real versus simulated time travel. It's like, is it real time travel? Well, like for all intents and purposes, if we're living in a simulation, mm-hmm. we want to know, can I change my past? And can I kill my grandfather? In this reality, whether it's real or not, it doesn't matter, right? Mm-hmm. Because what we really want to know is, can we travel through time in this world, whatever it is? And mm-hmm. in a simulated game, you could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Marcus. This has been great. Where can listeners go to follow your work?
Sure. My website is www.marcusarvan.com, MarcusArvan. Oh, sorry, .net, excuse me. MarcusArvan.net. I also blog at the Philosopher's Philosopher's Cocoon. And I run a really cool website on a Substack, a multimedia Substack on new work in philosophy with Barry McGuire and Willa Sadat from University of Edinburgh, where other philosophical authors, right, provide multimedia presentations of their new work in philosophy. And it's super fun. And so I hope people check it out.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. We'll link those in the show notes. Thanks again.
Awesome. Thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
In our next episode, we'll talk about the structure of agency and creativity, and our guest will be Joshua Shepherd, a career research professor at Autonomous University of Barcelona.